I Eat Green with Bhavani Jaraf, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first beautiful Wednesday of 2012. And I'm so happy to be here with all of you in this new year. I'm wearing my Occupy 2012 button. And I am just so happy to start each new year with you and to celebrate the future that we have together and of our planet. I start every New Year's in a really wonderful tradition. My family and I go up to Vermont, where we have some friends who own a house, and we gather there with some of our closest and dearest. Some of my siblings are there with me with their kids, along with some other friends, and we have what we now call our Big Chill Weekend. And we all come together and just hang. Some people skate, some people cross-country ski, although this year there was no snow, so we didn't do that. We have fireworks on New Year's Eve, a huge bonfire, and of course it's about the food too, and we cook and we clean and everything's done in such high spirit. And we started when my oldest daughter was 2, and she's now 32, and we celebrated this weekend our 30th anniversary of this annual gathering. And it's just amazing. Now there are there's so many kids, I can't even count them all. And they're all big, and some are married, and some are with significant others who have joined the party. And so New Year's Eve, I think we counted 44 people sleeping in the house. It was crowded. But you know what? The second generation, they just pile them all in downstairs, and there's a place for everybody. Nobody has to drive after drinking too much. Everyone stays put. And I realized, talking to a friend, that my children have never even seen the ball drop in Times Square. They don't even know. I'm sure they know what it is, but they've never seen it because in Vermont there's no TV. So we're all there celebrating New Year's Eve together, and that's how they have started their years for their whole life. And so it's a wonderful tradition, and I'm really happy to make PRN part of my tradition as well, and to join with all of you in wishing for this new year all good things. And I'm really excited because one of my guests today is Jamie Cloud of the Cloud Institute, and she is working to really make some change happening. Her institute helps to educate schools in how to teach for the future, and I'll tell you more about her before I introduce her a little bit into the show. But, you know, the work she's doing is really the way we all have to go, and so it's very exciting. I also have some recipes, of course, to share with you. And I also just want to go through some of the upcoming events that are coming up in our area and in the greater New York area. And as always, if you know of any events coming up that you think I should share with my listening audience, please send them my way. I am Bhavani, and you can send them to bhavani@ieatgreen.com. And I'd love to hear from all of you. So the first thing is a series of carbon farming courses that are taking place at the Pfeiffer Center in Chestnut Ridge, New York. And the Pfeiffer Center is a biodynamic center, an educational center. And they also are having a biodynamic course the weekend before. But this is a series of seminars and classes that you can take from January 17th through February 5th. They have lots of guests coming there. Joel Salatin, who was our keynote speaker at the Small Farm Summit last year, will be there one of the workshops. So if you're interested, go to the Pfeiffer Center website, uh, P PFEIFFER Center website and take a look at the schedule. Also, the NOFA New York conference is coming up, and this is the winter conferences. NOFA, you know, all over has their winter conferences. So there's NOFA Massachusetts. You know, this is NOFA New York in January 20th to the 22nd. It takes place in Saratoga Springs each year, and it has really grown. I was there last year, and there had to be, I don't know, at least 500 people, maybe more. It's really quite large, and there's over 80 workshops going on, three keynote speeches, as well as a whole trade show area and entertainment and local organic meals. Different farmers bring produce from their gardens and cook for us. So it's a wonderful thing. And I'm hoping some of you out there are planning on joining me in Mexico on January 21st. From January 21st to the 28th, I will be at Rancho La Puerta teaching cooking classes at their spa cooking school. And the cooking school is called La Cocina Que Canta, and it's a full culinary center. And I'm really thrilled to be teaching three hands-on cooking classes. So I hope some of you are planning on joining me there. I know it was just rated, I believe, the top spa in the world in Travel and Leisure magazine. So it should be really a wonderful experience. I know I'm really looking forward to it. No farms, no food. That is really so true. If we don't have farms, we will not have food. So join us for a rally in Albany on February 15th at the state capitol. We need to let the governor know and raise awareness about the need to support our local farmers. And most of the farmers that we are supporting in this country through our subsidies are not our local farmers, or what we think of as farmers. Most of those farmers, actually, I found out, live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. They're not even on the farm. So we really need to support our local farmers, and this rally could really use your support. So if you feel like venturing up, there usually is a free bus from New York. I haven't checked the website recently to see if there is one for this rally, but I know in the past there's been a free bus from New York. So check the website, No Farms, No Food Rally. And I also sent out a weekly email that has a lot of the links to these things that I'm telling you about. So if you're interested, again, send me an email at bhavani@iegreen, and I'd be happy to add you to this weekly email list. Just Food, which is a wonderful local organization in New York, a nonprofit that is helping to bring CSAs and community gardens and urban farming to the city. They will be having their annual conference on February 24th. It's an all-day, actually a two-day event, Friday, February 24th, and Saturday, February 25th. So save the date for that. And then the New York Restaurant Show is also coming up, which is March 4th through 6th. And save the date for the second annual Long Island Small Farm Summit. And that's coming up April 14th. And we're really thrilled. As I mentioned a moment ago, Joel Salatin was our keynote speaker last year. This year we have Will Allen lined up from Growing Power in Milwaukee. You know, and all the work he's done in composting and urban farming. And we also have Chef Ann Cooper, the Renegade Lunch Lady, who will hopefully give us some insights into how to improve our school lunch programs on a large scale and really start to make a difference here. So that's what's going on in our area. There's lots of things you can take action from. Of course, there's opportunities through Food and Water Watch to support anti-fracking, which is really, really needs all of us to speak out against, and also the tar sands, which is, you know, working to prevent the approval of the Keystone Pipeline from Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico. That is also joining forces with 350.org. So instead of getting separate emails between 350.org and tar sands, they are now joining forces, and the people that have been working with them in their civil disobedience are joining forces. And so a lot of good things should be coming from that collaboration. So go to 350.org and join up and make sure you are on their email list, because they send out a wealth of information, and we need everybody's support to prevent the Keystone from being approved. In the last bill that was passed to on tax cuts, there was a provision that says that President Obama has to decide on the Keystone Pipeline in the next, I don't know, 30 days, 60 days, something very soon. So there's a timeline here. So really, get involved with that, and please sign any petitions that come your way. So I will just want to share two quick recipes with you, and they're about salad dressings, because so often I hear from my clients that their kids don't want to eat salad dressing, or salad dressings are so fattening. What can they do to lower the calories in their salad dressing? So these are two salad dressings that I make regularly that I love and are, you know, not very high in fat. One is a Japanese dressing, which consists of a stalk of celery, one onion, medium-sized, juice of half a lemon, juice of half an orange, 1-inch piece of ginger, some white pepper, just a touch, a half a cup of brown rice vinegar, a half a cup of tamari, 1 1/4 cup of canola oil, and 4 tablespoons of either ketchup or tomato paste. Ketchup makes it a little sweeter, so if you don't want the sugar, you can do the tomato paste. And that's it. Zip that up in the blender or food processor, and it's great. I realize this is a larger quantity than many of you might need to do, so just cut it in half if it's too much for you. And then if you want to take away the 1 1/4 cups of oil, you can just put in half a cake of tofu into the blender instead, and everything else remains the same, and it's still delicious, and you've now cut out the oil and added some protein, so that's a really great substitute. And that's what I do for my tofu raspberry vinaigrette as well. I do a quarter cake of tofu, and I use the soft tofu, 1/4 cup of orange juice, 2 tablespoons of raspberry vinegar, 2 sprigs of dill, 1/2 stalk of celery, 10 fresh raspberries, organic, must be organic, and then 1 teaspoon of agave or pomegranate molasses, just to sweeten the dressing a little bit, and some salt and pepper. And again, you just process that in the food processor. If you'd like, you can also add some cucumber or onion or garlic to that. And that is it. And those are two wonderful dressings. But just, you know, feel free to play around with substituting tofu for the oil in your salad dressings, and it lightens it up a lot, and it's quite delicious. So now I get to my favorite part of the show, where I get to introduce my guest. And as I mentioned before, Jamie Cloud from the Cloud Institute is my guest today, and she's the founder and president of the Cloud Institute, which is an institute that prepares kindergarten through 12th grade school systems and their communities to educate for a sustainable future. And she does this by inspiring educators and engaging students through meaningful content and learner-centered instruction. So that means it's participatory, and it's, you know, it really gets people involved. Jamie also works extensively with educators and administrators and school boards across the nation, designing and facilitating professional development programs to help them work in a collaborative way to improve their instructional units and their already existing curriculum, how to improve it and how to incorporate some of these sustainable ideas into the different disciplines. So, Jamie, are you there?
I am.
Welcome. So glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Bhavani. Nice to be here.
Thank you. So, you are a busy lady. When did you first start the Cloud Institute, and what was your inspiration or your motivation behind starting the Cloud Institute?
I always tell the story of how I began this work by explaining that it really started for me when I was 11, and I won't go year by year since then, but I was in the first experiment in global education as a sixth grader, and we walked into sixth grade, and our teacher said, now you have to take responsibility for your own learning, because we have to prepare you for the 21st century, and we know very little about the world you're going to inherit. And so they talked a bit about the world the characteristics of the world we would live in and what it was going to take to educate for that world. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, that seems like a lot of work. Just tell me what you want to do, me to do, and I'll do it. But, of course, that doesn't work if you need transformation. And so from the 6th to the 12th grade, I was taught to be a change agent and to educate for the future we want.
Wow. But, where was that?
Evanston, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And so I grew up to be a global educator. And then in 1987, Our Common Future report came out that coined the phrase sustainable development. And we had been tracking the state of the planet data since I was 11, but I didn't have a word to describe that the situation was unsustainable until the word sustainability arrived on the radar. And I thought, well, that's the future I want to educate for. What is it, and how do you educate for it? And that was the beginning. And so by 95, we founded the center, and here we are.
Wow. Well, that was very forward-thinking there in Illinois, wasn't it?
Yeah, who knew? Yeah, all our teachers were educated by luminaries like Buckminster Fuller and other leaders of the time. So we had no idea, of course, at the time, but I learned over time why they were saying things like that. And it was amazing. They knew that the world would be characterized by rapid change, more and more complexity and interdependence, more and more diversity, more and more uncertainty and global challenges. And so they taught us how to learn to learn, how to think about our thinking, and how to stay open-minded and become change agents and how to invent the future we want. And so it makes sense that I do what I do. I was educated for it.
I had a very different experience, but somewhat similar. I walked into ninth grade algebra, and they said, well, you know, we're going to be teaching you now for the future, so you're no longer going to have a teacher. You're going to be sitting in a cubicle learning from a tape recorder how to do algebra.
Interesting. Did it work?
Chapter by chapter. Please open your book to chapter 2. It didn't take long for everybody to start bringing in, you know, tapes of Grateful Dead,
right,
James Taylor.
Right.
No, it didn't work. It definitely was not. I think they abandoned the project at the end of the year. But meanwhile, you know, I still was on algebra in 10th grade.
Right.
Because I could not learn like that.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, they also don't wait long enough oftentimes with innovation. Schools were not designed for innovation. They weren't even designed for learning, let alone change and innovation. So they very rarely wait long enough for any innovation to take hold. So it may have been a bad idea, or they may not have waited long enough.
I think it was a bad idea. But anyway, I'm glad your situation worked out.
Yes.
So how do you go about bringing your curriculum into schools? Do you actually, you know, go into a school and revamp everything they're doing, or do you, you know, bring parts of what you do into it?
There are a few different entry points for the work that we're doing. If school systems know they want to do this work and they call us, then we start with the leadership group and we work on a change strategy. We are looking at whole systems change, because this is to educate for the future we want. It's not a matter of tweaking anything. It's a mid-course correction.
Right.
And so it's a whole systemic change initiative, starting with the goal of education in that school or that district. And if the goal is to educate for a healthy and sustainable future and to contribute to kids' individual and collective potential and that of the living systems upon which we all depend, what we call education for sustainability, then we start where there are favorable conditions. Normally what we do is spend the first couple of days with the whole faculty or a cross-section of faculty who are interested, and we do a deep dive transformative learning experience so that everyone has a shared understanding of what what is sustainability, what is education for sustainability, so that they have a chance to develop a rationale for why they'd want to get involved and to understand the role that education plays in making the shift towards sustainability. So once everybody's transformed, then there's usually a number of people who are early adopters who are ready to innovate curriculum. And so while we work with, for example, that cohort one, everyone else has an opportunity to do something. And so we start a lot of self-organizing projects. Some people are interested in the cafeteria. Some are interested in gardens. Some just want to do more professional development. There's a variety of ways people can get engaged. And while that's all spinning, while those plates are spinning, we work with the leadership team to continue to look at, read the feedback and self-correct and keep our plan moving forward, how to engage the board, how to engage the parents, and so forth. So it works beautifully. The teachers love it. The kids are on fire. Everybody's happy. So and we like it. If teachers are happy, everyone can be happy. Now, if the school systems don't know to call us, it's generally a sustainable community initiative that's interested in moving towards sustainability, and we would then reach out to them and say, how far do you think you can get in sustaining this initiative without all the children, young people, and their teachers? Mm-hmm. And so they will say, well, that's a great idea, but we don't know how to engage the schools. And, of course, that's where we come in. And it works both ways. Sometimes the school system takes the leadership role and reaches out then to the community, and other times it's the other way around. And it's a system, so there's no beginning or end. There's no right way to do it. You start where there are favorable conditions.
Right, right. It's the same, you know, when we're trying to bring food in. You start mm-hmm. where
exactly.
where there's an in.
Exactly. And that's just, you know, change agent 101.
Right. And then, you know, of course, you know, the thing I always hear, and I'm sure you hear too, and so I'm going to ask you as a question, what kind of funding is there for this? Because, you know, with every school, or do you only or mostly get private schools coming
to
you?
Oh, no, no. We are working with a very wide range because we want to demonstrate that this works no matter what your circumstance. So if they're high-end independent schools, they pay for it themselves, and usually they will do they either just take it out of their budget for professional development and coaching, or they will do a fundraiser with parents and raise the money that way.
Mm-hmm.
If they're in a, let's call it a regular medium level, they'll either take it out of their budget, they'll pool together at the Putnam Northern Westchester BOCES up here in Westchester. There are 17 districts that pooled their resources to create a regional sustainability education initiative. So sometimes they'll do that creatively.
Oh, that's a nice idea, so they can share within
exactly.
a region.
Right, exactly. And then we post the exemplary units online, and everybody can subscribe and feed into them. So that's a delicious way to do it. Oftentimes local funders, if it's a challenged neighborhood, then local funders are a great source of revenue. But so that's one way to answer the question. Another way is that if schools want to fund these things themselves, if they look around and there's nobody out there who's going to do it for them,
mm-hmm.
then the first thing we do is say, let's take the low-hanging fruits and stop wasting the materials and the energy here. And you can save anywhere from $60,000 to $100,000 a year in a building just by behavior change without any fancy footwork. And that's documented all over the country. And so, you know, let's make generate some revenue that way. So one way we do it is to say, all right, look, if we start cycling materials, being really conservative about materials use, and we save energy by turning lights off and powering down and so forth, you save a lot of money. We always say, before you start these initiatives, make sure the administration knows you want 30 to 50% of the revenue savings put back into professional development and coaching and curriculum innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise they'll just cut your your budget.
Right.
So you have to make the deal up front.
Uh-huh.
The second thing is you can save another big chunk of money because you are more and more. Now, this is a little bit takes a little bit longer. The more you educate for sustainability, the better your attendance, the better your behavior issues, and the higher the achievement rate. And so you save a lot of money that you used to need to use on remediation, which you can now focus in at the front end to good instruction and good teaching and learning. And then the other thing is that a lot of schools are actually generating revenue both by if they have the some funding to invest, they can actually generate revenue because they generate more energy than they use, or they're actually growing food. A lot of the schools that we work with are actually growing food through green roofs, edible walls, and kids are generating real revenue for themselves, their families, and their schools. So there are all kinds of ways to do it, and mm-hmm. it's really a mindset. You just have to want to do it, and creativity is a key property of all living systems and contributes to nature's inherent ability to sustain life. So if it's good enough for nature, we can be creative.
Right. Think outside of the box.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. So you recently came out with a press release about the EFS standards and performance indicators.
Yes.
What is that? And
well,
how can people sign on?
We use the term standards because that's education ease. You could call them outcomes. You could call them, what do we want kids to know and be able to do? So any of that will do. But in schools, we use the term standards because that is the standard. If you say you are educating for sustainability, we want you to know what that looks like in a student, in curriculum, in assessments, in performance criteria, and in student work. What's the evidence of this new way of thinking? And so we developed over 15 years looking all over the world since Rio, really, since the first sustainability summit, people have been trying to figure out what are the core competencies. And so we've studied it, we've merged people's work, we've experimented, and after 15 years of working with these standards and performance indicators in several districts, with thousands and thousands of people, they were ready to publish to the larger community without us. So they are a series of core content standards, 9 core content areas that everybody needs to know and understand. There are some big ideas we call enduring understandings that go with them. And then a whole series of performance indicators, which basically means how do you know you've met the standard?
Mm-hmm.
So what does it look like? What are people actually doing or able to do that tells you, yes, they are definitely being educated for sustainability? So we're so proud to be able to offer it now for free. Everybody can download it. So, and the way we use them in school settings is that teachers will take a look at it, align all of our standards and indicators with their curriculum and their state standards. And by that way, they sort of draw a circle around the ones they're going to take responsibility for.
Mm-hmm.
And K to 12, all of them get delivered, reinforced, and mastered over time. But no one teacher does it all, of course. Although the more, the richer, the better. But nobody's expected to do everything because it's a whole system.
Yeah.
And they embed those right into their curriculum and assessments and performance criteria. And then if you're a non-formal educator or in higher ed or a parent, it's also extremely useful just to use as a frame of reference for what you're really looking for. What is that different way of thinking? How would we know it if we saw it, and how do you actually achieve it?
Mm-hmm. And this is downloadable now for
yes,
free.
Yes, it is.
Although I can recommend to everybody, since it's so large, that they can just keep referring to it on the computer. You don't even have to print it up.
Right. And actually, Atlas Rubicon, which is one of the big curriculum mapping software companies, has already embedded our standards into their software. So if any state or district wants to address our standards and they are mapping curriculum with Atlas Rubicon, they're already there, so they can just choose them and they'll be embedded right into their software, and teachers can just click on them as they're addressing them.
Oh, that's great.
That's great, yeah.
That's great, because one thing I also hear all the time, you know, I don't focus on the whole thing like you do. Obviously, I am just trying to address, you know, around gardens and mm-hmm. school cafeteria and, you know, farm to table to cafeteria, those
oh,
kind
yeah.
of things, and using those opportunities for teaching.
Absolutely.
But so often you hear that, you know, these teachers have to teach to all the tests, and they have no time to add anything into their curriculum.
Right.
And so what is sounding like so beautiful is you're not asking them to add anything. It's
yeah.
really just working with the curriculum they already have and ways to make it more rich.
Absolutely.
And
real. We always use the example, the metaphor, if you're thinking of curriculum as a crowded room that you're now trying to stuff more and more stuff into and thinking of add-ons, that's the wrong metaphor.
Right.
Think of a rich, colorful garden. The richer, the better. You know, I say to people, you know, if you have kids, when you had your first child, your day didn't get any longer. You wish it did, but it doesn't. And you have three kids, it doesn't get three times longer. You keep reorganizing, reorienting your day. You solve more than one problem at a time. You make it richer. You make it more effective, more efficient. Everything you do solves more than one problem at a time, minimizes the creation of new problems. That's how you do more and more with the same amount of time. And the state tests only measure 13% of the standards. So if you can't make the test the goal, the test is an indicator of a good education. It is not the goal. If you keep your eye on the prize and provide a rich standards-based instruction for kids that educates for a sustainable future, you will definitely be able to address 13% of the standards that are tested by the state.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a problem. And in fact, we've demonstrated that. The impact studies that we have to date demonstrate without a doubt that education for sustainability improves student learning and standards achievement across the board, so
mm-hmm.
we can get that right off the table.
That's so great. I want to go into some of these standards in a little bit more detail in
good.
A few minutes. We're going to take a couple-minute break.
Okay.
And when we come back, I really would like to dive into some of those core content areas.
Sure.
Okay?
Absolutely.
We'll be right back. Everyone, don't go away. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with Jamie Cloud, my guest today from the Cloud Institute. And she founded the Cloud Institute to bring sustainable education into our schools and to teach for a sustainable future. And so we're having a great conversation. Jamie, are you with me again?
I am.
Great.
Of course, it doesn't make any sense to educate for an unsustainable future, does it?
No, it doesn't, but that seems to be what
yeah.
a lot of schools are doing.
Inadvertently, and yeah.
You know, there's
purpose.
there's some beauty to, you know, being in the moment, but at the same time, you have to look towards the future, especially
yeah.
when you're with young people. And so, you know, I'm all about being in the moment, but at the same time, in the moment, we have to think of the future.
Exactly. And they're not mutually exclusive.
No. And, you know, I feel like so much of our education is just in this time warp bubble.
Mm.
I think I mentioned to you earlier when we were talking that, you know, when I see all these science or these young high school students, 11th and 12th graders, participating in the Intel science competitions and,
right.
you know, so many different competitions, and I read about what they're doing, not only can I barely understand it or pronounce it, but it just seems like it's in such a bubble. It has nothing to do with using this creative mind that these young, bright students have towards something that is going to improve the future.
Yeah.
You know, the situation that we're in right now. How,
right.
you know, ways to use plastics in a recyclable way.
Right.
Way to work with trash, ways to work. I mean, there's just so many. It's endless.
It's the difference between design thinking and innovation and sustainable design thinking and innovation. And the three things that you often will see missing, the first order of business in sustainable design thinking is this worth doing? Should I spend, of all the things that need to be done, is this something worth doing? Mm-hmm. And you have to address that question. The second one is, what are the design parameters? What are the ecological principles and the design parameters that would make it a sustainable design?
Mm-hmm.
And the third is, let me use those constraints to drive my innovation, not try to tack them on at the end. It never works to do it the other way around. So
right.
using constraints to drive the creativity. If you do that, then you'll have a whole different set of innovative ideas. I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah, and constraints really do. I mean, a lot of times, boundaries is freedom. You know, you have so much more ability to think when you are working within certain constraints because you're not all over the place.
Absolutely. And healthy systems require limits. They have limits.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why our hearts don't just keep growing exponentially. The hearts have to work with all the other parts. Tapping the power of limits is a principle of sustainability.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of the principles of sustainability
sure.
and the core content areas that you mentioned in the EFS
mm-hmm.
standards. There's 9 core?
Yes.
Is it 9?
9 core content areas, yes.
Okay, so what would they be?
The first one is, and there's no sequence here, it's a system, so they're all interrelated to one another. So think of them in a web, but I'll put a spotlight on one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one I'll talk about is cultural preservation and transformation. And so that has 3 dimensions. The first one has to do with the fact that healthy ecosystems there's a correlation between healthy ecosystems and a healthy ethnosphere or cultural sphere. Healthy people, healthy ecosystem. And a lot of people don't understand that connection. So that's the first part. The second is just to be aware that we want to preserve what needs to be preserved and change what needs to be changed, and to plan for that. If you want to be sustainable, certain things will have to be preserved and certain things will have to change over time. We usually get it the wrong way around, but if you can get that one right,
mm-hmm.
you're golden. And then the third is the role of the arts and literature in helping us to preserve and transform in order to thrive over time. The next one is responsible local and global citizenship, and that's all about understanding what citizenship really is, activating participation, and leading change. The third is a nice big one on the dynamics of systems and change, and so that's really understanding interdependence and the principles of systems, and then using systems thinking to operate successfully in interdependent systems. Sustainable economics, we need to understand and inform our choices and make informed choices. We need to understand life cycle analysis and full cost accounting and why, how to invest really in the green economy and the relationship between economic systems, social and natural capital.
And also what you talked about before, sustainable economics would be cutting back on your energy and, like you talked about the low branches to create the money that you need to bring this education to your students.
Right.
You can do that through...
Absolutely. Until you can go to renewables, just reducing at the moment, it's slowing down on the way to the cliff. If you're headed towards the cliff, slowing down is not going to solve your problem, but it will at least buy you some time so that you can turn and make a mid-course correction away from the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And so slowing down at the moment until we can turn to renewable, clean, green energy, that's absolutely a money saver as well as a human life saver.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is the healthy commons. Commons are defined as those places and things upon which we all depend and for which we're all responsible. So everything from our shared future to trust to public spaces and you name it. They have been, we call it, making the invisible visible, because they've not been on our radar, and most of the things that are now in decline are part of the commons, because nobody was keeping an eye on them, because they didn't understand they depended or had responsibility for them. The next one is knowing what the operating instructions are for the planet, the natural laws and ecological principles. Most people have absolutely no idea what that even means. But things like the first law of thermodynamics, which is another way of saying there is no such place as away, and other really good principles that are non-negotiable that we need to understand so we can thrive over time on this planet. Mm-hmm. The next one we call inventing and affecting the future, and that's all about envisioning and creating and thinking out of the box and tapping our passions and developing perseverance skills and risk-taking skills, finding our strength in our individuality, and believing that we can succeed and taking responsibility for the difference we make. Two more. The eighth one is multiple perspectives, really understanding that diversity makes our lives possible. It's not something you tolerate. And so appreciating diversity and developing what we call perspective consciousness, just understanding that everyone sees the world from a different perspective, and the more perspectives put together on a topic, the more you're going to understand that thing, and that's a beautiful thing. So rather than to prove you're right, use each other's perspectives to learn and to seek more and more understanding. And then finally, a strong sense of place, really connecting to the places in which we live. So we fall in love with them, so we want to take care of them so they can take care of us.
Mm. That's beautiful.
Beautiful, huh?
Mm-hmm. Really beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're so well received. Everybody falls in love with them. And contrary to what you would think, everybody loves them and they want to address these. And they say, well, of course this is why kids should be in school. And it's not what we're doing, but it's certainly what we should be doing. And let's get at it. So the response has just been overwhelmingly wonderful, which is so great. Every teacher wants what's best for kids. They just do, and this is it. And they also remember why they became teachers. This is meaningful, engaging, authentic. It's the best real idea,
right? It's the real stuff.
Yeah.
Do you come across much resistance? Like I just know when I've tried to introduce healthier food into school cafeterias, which is, you know, again, depending on the population that you're working with, sometimes people are happy about it, and sometimes people feel like you're telling them that they don't, that they're feeding their children bad food, that you know they take offense to it. And
right.
So I've learned how to tread very lightly in that area.
Right, right. So the brain scientists have been very, very helpful in this regard, because change is a death threat from the brain's point of view. Uncertainty is a threat. And if you threaten someone's status, their identity, if you introduce uncertainty, they immediately have a fear response or a
mm-hmm.
threat response.
Right.
So what we need to do always is to give them enough, what we call, they also talk about the fact that people need their autonomy, absolutely. But before they can exercise their free will to change, they sometimes need to exercise their free won't, which I just love. Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to have a rationale for why you need to change. But just enough rationale to change, not so much that you get the fear response and you shut down. Because once nothing good can come from that fear state. All your neural pathways shut down because you're supposed to be running if you're in a fear state. So we definitely pay a lot of attention to that and are very strategic about helping people understand why they need to change without, and at the same time getting the other response, which is the toward response, if you will, the happiness response, the inspiration, the creativity. But the basic areas of resistance have to do with the automatic resistance has to do with perceptions, first of all. There's no shared understanding of what we all mean by sustainability and education for sustainability, so people will attach some meaning to it that it doesn't have. And so that's, we have to get through that in terms of a shared understanding in language. We have identified a series of mental models or schema or paradigms people are operating with that get in the way, like one we call the Titanic syndrome. People think, well, there's not enough to go around, we're working with scarcity, so if we're going down anyway, we might as well go first class. And so they've already decided that mm-hmm. the ship is sinking, so why not just enjoy it while it lasts?
Mm-hmm.
Another one is the bummer. Things are the way they are, and there's nothing we can do about it. And so those kinds of ways of thinking definitely need to be shifted. And so they can be, they can cause resistance. A lot of people have lost faith in schools. They don't believe that schools can change. They've lost faith in the public schools especially. Now, the tricky thing is that we keep sending the majority of children there to a system that people have given up on. And I think that's a very bad combination. So if you want to give up on schools and invent something else, do it. But do not send all the children to a system you've given up on. So, but a lot of people have, and so that's a barrier. And I would say that the last bit is that I would say it's pretty rare for people to understand that kids and young people are leaders in this area, already leading as well as capable of doing more. People think of education as a 20-year payback, that you have to wait 20 years till the kids grow up for them to be able to have return on investment. And, well, that's just crazy talk. If you know any children, you know that as soon as they hear about this, they are they're finally doing amazing things in districts that haven't been able to pull things off in 20 years. And they're getting zero waste initiatives going, and they are creating sustainable food systems, and they are just, in one case of a high school student up in Vermont, she converted her school building from oil to pellet stoves, then created a statewide initiative, and got $20 million and 100,000 acres of land from the state to grow their own switchgrass and material to make the pellets. And she did all that while she was in high school. Jessie Ruth Corkins, she's my hero.
God. What is her name?
Jessie Ruth Corkins.
Mm-hmm.
She got an award for that, which is how, we found out about her. But that's not an unusual story.
Right.
I mean, she's amazing, and we collect those kinds of stories of children, the little ones, second and third graders, reducing waste 80% in their building in 3 weeks and sustaining it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Things adults couldn't do, in years. So the children and the young people are leading this effort, and people need to recognize that, and why we say education is so important. So I would say those are the resistance areas, none of which are insurmountable if we can get in the door,
mm-hmm.
if we can have a conversation and provide a transformative learning experience. It doesn't take very long for people to realize, in the same way that the folks during Copernicus's time realized, okay, everything doesn't revolve around us, let's get over it and move on.
And mm-hmm.
People are realizing, okay, we need to life organizes toward life on this planet, and we all need to get on that page.
Right. Wow. Well, those are great inspirational stories.
Yeah, they are. You
want
to hear some more?
I would. I was just going to ask you, because I know that you've been, what school have you been in the longest?
Oh, gosh, that's hard to say. We've been at this so long. But let's see, this is our fifth year up in Westchester. We just started a statewide initiative in New Jersey in partnership with the Sustainable Jersey Initiative, which is a municipal system, somewhat like a LEED certification for municipalities that's just caught fire in the state of New Jersey. And we've started working with Cherry Hill Public Schools and Cranford Public Schools so far as the first school community partnerships for sustainability in the state, which are very very exciting.
Well, I know a few years ago I took a workshop. I met this woman that started all the all the school gardens in Princeton. I believe every school in Princeton, New Jersey,
right,
had a school garden.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's so many wonderful things going on. What we want to do by taking a systemic change approach and by embedding this way of thinking in the curriculum and instruction, we believe that it can then sustain the environment for all of those kinds of initiatives to thrive over time, because any one of them is vulnerable unless they're tied to all the others, and there's a shared understanding and awareness, and that's part of the DNA of the school and or the district. So we work with several independent schools, Trevor Day School and Marin Country Day School. We are working here in New York City. We wrote the entrepreneurship course and the participation in government course for the New York City Public Schools. The Denver Green School is doing amazing work. But the real comprehensive work is more recent because no one was ready for it before. So it's more, at this point, it's, you know, what's going on now that we could point to. But I do have some data if you want to hear what some of the impact is. I mentioned, and now this is from several impact studies around the country, from researchers who are external evaluators to sustainability education programming. So we know that it improves student learning and standards achievement. We know that it enhances attitudes towards learning, produces better behavior and attendance, significantly decreases students feeling that they cannot succeed, which is more and more an issue for kids. It produces statistically significant increases in the strength of students' attitudes about civic engagement, develops a greater awareness of community and appreciation for the democratic process. Pretty good, huh?
Yeah, all that.
Uh-huh. It helps them become risk takers, develop skills of active participation.
Risk takers, mind
you. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Not bungee jumping.
Right. Healthy risk takers.
Out of the box thinking kind of risks.
Uh-huh.
Right. It encourages them to make connections between themselves and the systems of which they're a part. And so that's the student outcomes so far that we have. In terms of impact on teachers, huge impact on teachers' happiness and ability to achieve strong academic outcomes, and that's for new and veteran teachers. And then the impact on schools and communities, I have a few indicators. We've improved children's health by improving their food eating choices, thanks to you and all the people doing the gardens and farm-to-cafeteria work. We've improved whole school cultures and relationships between the school, parents, and community, modeling actions and attitudes that promote sustainable living, and there's lots of data coming in now that we are improving air quality, reducing waste, and decreasing energy use, and improving, you know, budgets in that respect.
So, well, I am so happy to, you know, share what you're doing with others. How can people get in touch with you? Because I want to make sure we get that up there
before people run
out of time. And I want to be a spokesperson for you.
Wonderful.
Get all of Long Island.
We need all the help we can get.
Get everyone on board.
We are at www.cloudinstitute.org. Go to the website, get on the mailing list, make an inquiry, subscribe to the Cloud Commons and to the newsletter. Get involved. The best thing is for people to encourage their school systems to get an awareness level training so that people can understand what the heck this is all about.
Now, you have a training coming up?
I will be in Cherry Hill, actually, tomorrow and Friday. And we have a summer design studio every summer where we do the deep dive trainings, and we offer them throughout the year on site in districts and schools, and sometimes here in our shop in New York City. So, and they're all on the newsletter and the website, so we're really good at making sure everybody knows where we're going and when other people can come. So the best thing is to get on Twitter and just, you know, stay in touch and work on your school systems so that they can educate for the future we want.
Absolutely. It's such great work that you're doing. Thank you on behalf of everybody. Thank you.
Oh, Bhavani, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
And I certainly will try to encourage. I love the idea that people can do it cooperatively, that school districts don't have to necessarily take it on but themselves, but they can do it as a region, which also, you know, with Facebook and all the communication that kids have between districts now. Like
exactly.
When I was in school, we just stayed with one district.
Yeah.
Now between all the sports and all the Facebook and the computers, everybody knows people from different districts. It's just another way that people can collaborate.
Exactly.
It's
and
wonderful.
That's the name of the game in this world.
Right, right. There's enough for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Enough for everybody.
Mutually beneficial relationships. Very sustainable.
Yes. Well, that's thank you so much for joining us, and we'll definitely be in touch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And everybody out there, have a wonderful rest of the week. Please think about getting involved and try to bring the Cloud Institute standards to your school. Think collaboratively, and we can make it happen. Everyone, have a great week, and Happy New Year to all of you.